The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Monday, July 24th, 2017. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The Trump acolytes have taken to the airwaves to argue that the attention paid to Russia, the infighting and the attorney general regret, some Napoleonic misinterpretation and the like, has all been an example of media misdeeds. Talking about those things. What we've been doing is we've been distracting from what should have been the real discussion. Here's Fox News contributor Eric Bolling on This Week with George Stephanopoulos making his case.
He moves forward. He moves the media. He moves the story forward. He stays in the news. I will tell you unequivocally, I spoke to him yesterday. He's very frustrated about Russia being the focus of everyone's conversations. That's right. when he would like to focus on other things. He'd like to talk about other things, but it doesn't. The media never gets there. He sits down with the New York Times. What happens? They talk about Russia.
Now, here's the problem. Not even getting into the fact that the Russia story really is a story. Bolling there is engaged in a discussion about what the media should be discussing. He says it shouldn't be discussing what they have been discussing. But here is my advice. The president has a tool in his arsenal that could prompt the media to start talking about something else. And that tool is for him to start doing. Now, all the media can do is discuss. It's wrapped up in the definition of the name. But Trump, who is a creation, an exemplar, and a student of the media, thinks that this is all he can do too. It's not true. He can do things, and once he does things, the media will cover those things. But since Trump has no healthcare law, no infrastructure plan, no fleshed out tax reform, that's all he can do. Kellyanne Conway had at it. She was on Reliable Sources. First voice you'll hear is Brian Stelter.
I think people can care about multiple issues at the same
time. Right, so why aren't you
Certainly,
covering them? Why are most
that
of your lower thirds?
Care about a lot of issues.
Of course. Yeah. That's America and that's Donald Trump. He ran on a lot of issues. He's making good on those promises with or without the help of a number of cable stations. But let's be honest here. Stock market up 25 record highs. Fact. Over 800,000 jobs created. Fact. Healthcare reform on its way and tax reform right after that. Fact. Fact. But alternative facts, let me just repeat.
Let's start from the back and move forward. Tax reform, that's not a fact. It's an idea to have an idea one day. Healthcare reform on its way, not a fact. CNN has talked a lot about healthcare reform not being a fact. A lot of coverage, but the coverage is this isn't going to be a fact. So you can't really cover it as a fact if it's not a fact. 800,000 jobs created and stock market up, both true, both of questionable credit to the president. What, CNN should air report after report about how the S&P is up 8% since he was inaugurated? It doesn't sound like great coverage for CNN to me. And what would a report look like if they were talking all about the 800,000 jobs created? Might they say in June, President Trump created 222,000 jobs, preliminary figures? They might say that, and that might sound good to Trump. But they might also say, of the last 4 years, that was the third most jobs created in the month of June. Maybe they would say, in May, he created 152,000 jobs. And they might say, out of the last 4 years, that was the third highest number of jobs created. This is his pattern. Actions speak louder than words, but with no successful actions to speak of, Team Trump is reduced to words. I guess they figure no one can speak more forcefully than Kellyanne Conway, so they're happy to have this fight. Even if it's a fight they can't win, they can at least engage in it ad nauseum. On the show today, I spiel about an exhuming, an examination of an exhuming. But first, he was a member of the Kids in the Hall, and he has a podcast called Kevin McDonald's Kevin McDonald Show. Ladies and gentlemen, Luciano Casimiri. No, wait. I got that wrong. It's Kevin McDonald. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we kvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. My next guest needs no introduction, yet I will still give him one, as is the
Thank
conventions
you.
Of a podcast. Kevin MacDonald was one of the kids in the hall. Now he's a man. Who was a kid in the hall? He was a man.
Wow.
Then.
Yeah, I'm a man.
He was a man.
I'm still a kid in the hall. We haven't split up. We will only split up when one of us starts dying, probably Dave Foley.
But only when they start dying. What if it's a long and painful process?
We are very healthy.
You could squeeze a couple shows out of him, maybe, when he's on his deathbed.
That's true. Yeah, sure. We'll do 3 or 4 with Dave after. He's so healthy, we can do 3 or 4 with Dave after he's dead.
That's what he brings to the table.
Yes.
So I know kids in the hall were named after that Jack Benny phrase that he
Yes, well,
letters.
Actually, I'll be quick. I'll stop interrupting you, but Dave Foley once said Jack Benny, and so that's been the myth. But it's actually Sid Caesar had the kids in the hall, where he had his writer stable of writers, and young guys would pace the hall and try to sell jokes and sketches, and the ones who sold the most got hired. And the three famous ones are Neil Simon, Woody Allen, and Larry Gelbart.
Yes, and I do have to say that now it makes sense for a couple of reasons. You're a sketch show, and I wondered, would they even know Jack Benny? Jack Benny seems like kind of an American, like a specifically American guy who doesn't transcend. And also, you were born in the early 60s. Was Jack Benny popular then? Was he on TV? Well, so Sid Caesar would make sense.
Yes, except we knew Jack Benny. Dave Foley and I knew everything. We were we could teach comedy. We knew Jack Benny. We loved him. And he probably did have kids in the hall, too, like selling jokes at least.
Right. You guys, you and Dave were the Toronto guys.
Yes, Dave and I were the Toronto guys, and there were more Toronto guys, but they ended up quitting. And the Calgary guys were Bruce McCullough and Mark McKinney, and they had a lot of guys, and they eventually quit. So there was 4 losers who couldn't get jobs like on local TV shows. And then Scott Thompson happened to be a local Toronto guy who forced his way into. He just kept coming on stage, and we couldn't stop him.
Did the Calgary guys have culture shock? I don't know much about Canada, but Calgary's out there, and they're a cowboy town.
It's an artsy thing, and it's also a cowboy town. It's got the famous rodeo.
Yeah.
And in the early 80s, there was the great Calgary exodus of comedians and musicians and actors and writers. I'm motioning with my hand from West Canada to East Canada.
Yes.
I'm sorry you're missing it. And they were part of that exodus.
Did the Toronto guys have to orient and hold the hand of the more provincial Calgary guys in any way?
No, because Mark, he was in school, he became a Calgary guy, but he was the son of a Canadian diplomat who was the ambassador to the States at one point in Mexico, Jamaica. He's the most sophisticated kid in the hall. He's so sophisticated, Lorne Michaels will only talk to him when he has news for the troop. Mark, can you come into my office? The others, you stay outside. Thank you very much. And then we see them through the window talk.
Was it weird then that Lorne's contracts always were half the proceeds would go to him and the rest you guys had to share?
It made sense to us. Yeah. It made sense to us.
Honey, please, would you not?
Oh, come on, geez. Politeness is for strangers on a train.
Oh, well, that's true.
Not for old friends.
No,
God, how long have we known you guys anyways?
Oh gosh, it must be,
9 years.
Jeez.
If you include the year and a half that Tom spent in the coma.
Oh, yeah. The salad years, huh?
Yeah.
So when you played drag, when you played a woman,
yes,
did you have a kid who you most enjoyed being married to as the man? Who did you couple best with?
Well, Dave was so beautiful.
Yeah.
I remember the first time Dave dressed as a woman, I caught myself staring at him because we shared a dressing room. And I was just staring at him, and he turned around and said, what are you doing? No, nothing. I'm going over my lines. No, you were staring at me. Once somebody in the crew, because in our first season, nobody knew who the kids in the hall were. Like they didn't really know who was in the troupe. And when the first days of filming, Dave dressed up as a hooker, and one of the guys in the crew asked him out for a date. And Dave, being a polite Canadian, said yes.
Since you're a big fan of music, have you ever? I'm sure you've read about bands and their dynamics,
oh, yes.
And of course your dynamics. Do you think there's any band whose internal dynamics were like the kids in the hall that you know of?
Yeah, probably. Maybe Metallica.
Yeah.
Because I saw the documentary. And
Some Kind of Monster, was that it?
Yeah. And the only way, exactly. And the only reason we got up better than Metallica is because they had those 10 years in a van where they just lived in a van and they couldn't afford a hotel room. So that everything is heightened. I guess the good things are heightened too, but the animosity you have between one person would be heightened. We're Metallica divided by 10 because we don't have those van years. We were just a comedy trip. We didn't tour around in a van. But yeah, seeing them like argue, and it's totally different set of circumstances. But when what's his name, the lead singer, James Hatfield.
Yeah.
Where he can't work at night because he's going through AA. None of us are going through that. So he insists they don't work at night. In a totally different situation, that's the exact same kind of dynamic. You can't do that. But you can't do that. Yeah. Well, how can we do anything then?
Yeah. And also a lot of bands have the power center, you know, the Glimmer Twins or Lennon McCartney.
Yes.
And then the ballast. Often the bass player, I find.
Yes.
But the guy who is so calm. And then, you know, if you're a quintet like you guys were, was there that role?
Wow, we don't really have the calm guy.
Yeah.
The Glimmer Twins was probably Bruce McCullough himself. The closest thing to the bass player would be Dave, I would say.
Dave was the calmest.
Yeah. Yes, Dave was sort of the calmest. I could almost be that, but I do it with my nervous energy.
Yes.
So it's not like a bass player. It's more like a keyboard player.
Though a lot of times, and I've read a bit about you, and I think most of you grew up with, let's say, stern or abusive father figures.
Yes, yes.
A lot of times, those kind of people want to smooth the waters.
Yes.
They know how not to make waves.
I am that too. Yeah. Like, we'd have an argument. And Mark and Bruce would be arguing about a scene. I go, oh, I think Mark has a good point. And Bruce would tackle, oh, the Bruce has a good point too. Bruce would say something like, how can you sit there with a fence shut up your ass so high? And So yeah, I'm totally like that. The others aren't like that for some reason, but I'm more the classic son of an alcoholic.
And are you the only one? I haven't seen it, but I know you did a live show about the kids and
yes.
your dad.
Yeah, Hammy and the kids.
Hammy was your dad's
Hammy,
nickname.
Yes.
Are you the only one who turned that so explicitly into art, if you will? Because I know it's there in a lot of the
yes.
sketches. A drunk dad or an abusive dad or an angry dad.
Yes.
Yeah.
Bruce also did too. He wrote that scene where we all fantasize about beating up our dads.
Yes.
For sure. It would be me in first place for doing drunk dad things, and Bruce in second. Mark's dad just ignored him. He was the sophisticated high-class diplomat guy.
Right. Thus allowing him to flourish and talk to Lorne Michaels.
Exactly.
He had a plan.
Mark, can you ignore the others and come in to talk to me first? And once, I remember we were rehearsing. We were waiting to get into a rehearsal room, and we were all talking about horrible dad stories. And I would tell my horrible dad story that's in Hammy and the Kids, where I came from school. I wasn't that popular with girls, and my dad would say, how many? He was drunk. He wasn't at work. He was home drunk. How many girls called you take, Evan? Zero? Right. How many called you yesterday? Zero? Yeah. You know what zero times zero equals, don't you? Zero times zero always equals fag, my gay little mathematician. And Scott had a horrible story about his dad driving, drunkly driving up the hedge, like running over his hedge, trying to run him over.
Yeah.
And Dave had a horrible story. Everyone had horrible stories. Then it was Mark's turn, and he said, once, when I was in Jamaica, I saw my father fire my nanny in front of me.
Fodder.
And that's sad. Yeah. Like it's a different like level, but that's sad. But all I'm saying is you should have opened the stories. You don't you don't headline with that.
Hey, any of you guys ever beat up your dad?
What?
What?
What are you talking about?
Ever beat up your dad?
No.
Never?
No, I never
Not
beat up
once?
My dad. No.
Well, surely you've thought about it, though.
Well,
I thought so. Okay.
Well, maybe. I thought.
If you were going to do it, right? Do you think you could take him? Could you take your old man?
You know, think about it.
Yeah. I guess I could take him. I guess I could beat up my own father. Of course, he's 70.
I'd let him beat me up.
What?
What? Oh, then I'd let his guilt tear him apart.
Excuse me. Sorry, that counts.
No,
passive aggressive. That counts.
Oh, yes. Oh, we can be bastards, too. Oh, yes, sir.
So did you think, I used to think that comedy was forged of strife. But now there are so many people younger than me who just had these great, idyllic-seeming suburban childhoods where their parents convinced them, you should be on Saturday Night Live, and they were so nurtured, and they're really funny.
Yeah.
This is like upending all my expectations about what creates a funny person.
Yeah, and I hope that's true. That's healthy. And I know nothing about Stephen Wright, but he doesn't seem to have any demons, but I know nothing about his childhood. I know nothing. I always wondered if Steve Martin, he probably has more demons than I think he does, but he doesn't. They don't really come across in his comedy so much. But we bought that, the demons sort of drive us. Who's my favorite Beatle? John Lennon, the one with the demons. George Harrison probably had a couple demons. Paul McCartney seems demonless.
Yeah.
Yet he's still good.
Yeah.
He's still good. You've also
named the still alive one.
Yeah.
So maybe that correlates somehow.
Yeah.
Well, this wasn't Lennon's fault, I know, but yeah.
Well, it was the old, maybe he got rid of his demons and he got killed. Like Sam Kinison. Well, that's the myth, right? That he stopped drinking, he'd got his life back together, he was with a woman in a normal relationship, and then he got like in a car accident.
But that seems more like the story we tell ourselves, like the story that the person who's still beholden to drinking and drugs tells themselves.
That's why I use the word myth.
Yes, yes.
But that's the comedy myth.
Or like the fat guy who doesn't want to lose weight because then I'll be less funny, and then they do, and it's like, oh yeah, I'm still funny, just skinnier.
Yes, well, that's happened to me. I lost weight and. I was the overweight kid in the hall, but I don't know why I'm getting to that story.
When? I don't remember that.
Before the TV show. No. In 1987, when Lorne Michaels brought us to New York to write the pilot, that's when I lost the weight. New York. I lost the weight in New York.
Did Lorne, the whole company, did they treat you well? I mean, I maybe wouldn't have known you without them, but
right.
Were you remunerated for your labor?
They treated us well and that they took us out of nowhere. Lauren's always been great to us. Our lawyer did tell us we were signing the worst contract in showbiz history, but we were really nothing, right? Like only Lorne Michaels was the only guy that thought we were good, and we didn't care. When he brought us to the Brill Building where his office used to be when he wasn't at Saturday Night Live, it was like it was a big closet. Where we worked, but he was also being audited, so we were sharing the space with two auditors, and this was before like computers were getting. So they had their counting machines and their abacus, and every now and then when we said something funny, you could hear the two auditors giggle.
That's good audit humor.
That's good. More numbers.
Yeah. We had all the sketches were about carryover interest that year.
But they treated us well.
But can you live off kids' money?
No.
I have no concept of actually how popular you were. What are you telling me? Okay, let's go back.
My first thought was, no, you can't. But then the residuals, when we're getting on CISO now and before we were on Netflix, every 2 years we do get a good residual check. And I guess it's my biggest residual check. So why am I complaining? I'm not complaining. You took us from nothing, and the residual checks are amazing. I'm not complaining.
And as Americans, you're taxed less than the Canadians. Yeah.
I'm a dual citizen. I accidentally made the right amount of money where I'm being taxed by both countries. It's a crazy rule they have.
How popular were you? I thought you were everything. I mean, but I was a comedy nerd.
Right. Right. Well,
do you have any way of putting it in perspective?
Yes, we're a big cult.
Yeah.
I copy Scott Thompson's theory, his lemonade theory of comedy. And I think it totally applies. 80% of the people of the world love lemonade that is sweet and sugared. That's Saturday Night Live. And they all like it. But it's a lot of people. 20% of the people like lemonade with no sugar that's just sour. Only 20%, but the people who like it love it.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the kids in the hall. We're 20% sour lemonade. We only get the 20%, but they love it.
Yeah, you're the
Ramones. The Ramones, Pixies.
But there is a sweetness to the kids. So maybe it's more like a rye bread.
All right, rye bread is good. Yeah, that's good.
Do you think the kids would have thrived in this diffuse multi-channel world?
Wow, or good question.
Would have you maybe become more niche?
It's easy to be nichier here now. We've sort of created a thing where more and more people can be successful, but more and more people are successful in a nichey way. So maybe. And when I think about
And also your niche, per se, was still a pretty successful niche for the time. HBO, network shows. So that niche then, the 1995 niche, by orders of magnitude bigger than the 2016 niche.
I guess so, yeah. Yeah, when you put it that way. You're smart. That's good. And I always wonder about sketch comedy troupes. Now the difference, we had nowhere to... we couldn't film us and put us up on anything. We just had to be a stage troupe. As a result, when we did get a TV show, which is much harder because of that, we had our acting chops. I think nowadays people start filming things right away, and if they get a TV show, maybe they don't necessarily have their though that's not true, like Broad City. Because a lot of people are improvisers who do that. But I wonder, like, we were, like, as close as you can get to Metallica in a van for a comedy troupe for, like, 5-6 years before we before Lauren finally got us our... I'm not complaining, Lauren, before Lauren got us our TV show.
Kevin MacDonald, A Kid in the Hall, his new podcast, and I'm glad you got this gig because when I heard that they had announced something called Kevin MacDonald's Kevin MacDonald Show, I said I know who'd be perfect for it, and it was you. It was Kevin MacDonald.
See, it is a good title.
He's also out with apparently a scathing anti-Lorne Michaels memoir. I don't know where this is.
No, it's called I'm Not Complaining, Lorne.
I'm Not Complaining, Lorne. Read Between the Lines as a Canadian excoriates.
Between the Lines, it also says I'm not complaining, Lorne.
Kevin MacDonald, a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. And now the spiel. I think it will take only a few more days to get to the bottom of a great international mystery. Trump, Kushner, Russia. No, this one.
And a story out of Spain has a lot of people talking. A judge has ordered the body of artist Salvador Dali to be exhumed.
They exhume Salvador Dali. Here's a description of the process. Technicians started by removing a heavy stone slab that gave access to the crypt with Dali's tomb. They were to extract four teeth, nails, and the marrow of a long bone. A small committee of five people oversaw the opening of the coffin. The process took 1 hour and 20 minutes, officials said. Of course, it's hard to keep time because, you know, the clocks kept melting. What they found inside just might shock you. Well, it's Salvador Dali, a man who once gave a lecture wearing a deep-sea diving suit and a helmet. He was carrying a billiard cue and leading a pair of Russian wolfhounds at the time, and the helmet had to be unscrewed because he couldn't breathe. So I'm going to say maybe it won't really shock you, but it was a little bit surprising. Salvador Dali's mustache, his famous mustache, was still intact. Salvador Dali once issued a book which consisted entirely of uses of his mustache, like poking through some Gruyere cheese. Dali's mustache dipped in honey, attracting a fly. And now we have a posthumous Dali mustache, which has endured 30 years after the last breath was drawn from the lips upon which it gained purchase. I'm going to weigh in and say this exhumation seems ill-advised. The woman who is claiming to be Dali's illegitimate daughter has a brother who is not Dali's son. So someone said, why don't you just test the living brother? And if he's a full sibling of the woman, then Dali's not the father. Now, we should say, if the woman is proved to be Dali's daughter, she will be entitled to a quarter of the Dali estate, most of which has already been bequeathed to Spain and a foundation bearing his name. So who does that help? This woman, 61-year-old from Spain, is a tarot card reader on local TV and a fortune teller. So if she's wrong, not only will she miss out on the Dali payday, I can see her Yelp rating suffering quite a bit. But I think the biggest insult to Salvador Dali isn't that he has been disinterred. That doesn't seem to be an affront to a man obsessed with wretched decay of the corporeal form. I think the insult is the lazy use of the word surrealism in describing this story. I could scarcely find mention of this without some clever headline writer noting that it was quite a surreal turn of events. When surrealism becomes truism, it is an insult beyond the normal degradation of a once vibrant word that slips into cliche. Once surreal, now jejune. Beyond this story, the word surreal seems to have become a crutch for any event that's hard to describe. In fact, I was looking up uses of the word surrealism, and it's often juxtaposed next to that very phrase, hard to describe. I don't know, it was hard to describe. It was kind of surreal. Sometimes surreal is used to describe accidents that are unexpected.
Nothing looked too out of the ordinary. You didn't really pay much attention. And then all of a sudden, it was skidding across the runway on its belly. There was black clouds of smoke.
And what about the people around you? I mean, was there lots of confusion? Were other people doing the same? What was the scene like then?
It was a bit surreal.
Sometimes it's used to describe events that are discordant, like a teacher from rural Canada winning an international prize given to her in outer space.
McDonnell says it was surreal when her name was announced from the space station.
Maggie McDonnell.
She even took a few of her students along for the ride.
It's not that these people are using surrealism wrong. Surrealism isn't any one thing. It means something close to dreamlike, and there's no one thing that a dream is like. Surrealism is actually this really useful word that's there for you when you're struggling for a description of the inexplicable, because it means having the qualities of the inexplicable. That said, an attempt to cash in on the fortune of a man you've never met, that is far from inexplicable. So too, it turns out, is the intact facial hair on a body after it's dyed. Facial hair contains keratin, which resists decomposition, sometimes for centuries. The persistence of mustaches. That's it for today's show that just was produced by Mary Wilson, who, like Salvador Dali, lives on in spirit as she vacations. Unlike Salvador Dali, her mustache does not live on. Chris Berube, producer of The Gist, has improved upon Dali's famous sculpture of a lobster as a telephone. He's created a newer, smaller, pocket-sized crayfish as cell phone, and you don't have to buy a protective case. It has its own shell. Steve Lickteig, executive producer of Slate Podcasts. He's down with the diver suit. He's down with the wolfhounds. But the billiard cue? How about a polo mallet made of meringue? Now that's surreal. The Gist, a prominent television tarot card reader, also claimed to be my offspring, but a DNA test with Miss Cleo proved nothing. Ooh-peru-de-peru-do-peru, and thanks for listening.